Well, we'll be coming in a few moments to that part of the passage that I read out to you in Ecclesiastes 2 through into chapter 3. As I said last week, this is not a systematic exposition of Ecclesiastes. We'll be looking at the various themes that arise as we proceed through the series. I mean, having done a fair bit, not exhaustive, but a fair bit of research to try and establish what the underlying structure is of the book of Ecclesiastes, I was relieved to find out that there was no agreed, unified structure of the book. And that's helpful when you cannot find one yourself. Although I was quite encouraged just this week in reading the latest Banner of Truth magazine, and it was quite by accident, I picked it up at a friend's house, and there's a two-page thematic outline of this very book by a man called Benjamin Miller, who had been struggling with the exact same problem, and that proved to be quite helpful. Just to remind ourselves what this book is about, it's about a man, a preacher, some take to be Solomon, there's no definite agreement on that, but we're not to lay ourselves wondering whether it was Solomon or not. We call the man the preacher, who preached this sermon, and he preached it from a certain viewpoint. He preached it on a horizontal level. He's looking at the world, he's looking at life, under this term, under the sun, or under heaven. And last week, one of the points I brought out, and I'm not going to bring all the points of last week, but one of them, the essence of the book of Ecclesiastes is that it is a book of comfort. Its primary purpose is to comfort the believer. And it's comfort in this way. It makes it absolutely clear that we cannot answer all the complexities of life, even as believers. There is a randomness in life that thwarts any attempt to draw conclusive answers. We have an existence, this side of heaven, in this world of constant movement, in a world of constant sameness. There's a sort of paradox. And we thought about this word that he uses quite a lot, that all is vanity, that it's a Hebrew word meaning vapor or breath, something that is fleeting. In some instances, the context means it's futile. But let us remind ourselves as to why things are the way that they are. In chapter 1, verse 13, he uses a very interesting expression. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. An unhappy business. That's sad, really, because our primary desire as human beings is for happiness. We were created to be happy. The one thing that we do not like is unhappiness. And yet here we have this attributed to God. Why does he attribute to God the cause of this unhappy business we call life? Your ability to accept what comes next will very much depend on whether or not you're a Christian. We've got to look back just briefly at the beginning of things. In the book of Genesis, we have a narrative that tells that God made the world and everything in it, and it was very good, and it was free of sin. He set man over the vast creation with a great degree of freedom, and with the exception of access to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, man could do anything he wanted and had a perfect relationship with God. And yet man disobeyed this instruction. And what happened next was exactly what God said would happen. Man died. He died in two senses. He became capable of physical death, but he also died spiritually. He was separated from God, and sin permeated everything in creation. You can read that in the first three chapters of Genesis. In this whole unhappy episode, God made a promise to redeem the situation, but nevertheless, the consequences of that event live with us today. We're all suffering from that. Indeed, the action of Adam, way back in history, set a process running that reveals not only did his sin permeate creation, all of his offspring, that's you and me, but it permeated to such an extent that we follow the same desire as Adam. We want to usurp God. We ultimately want to run the show ourselves. Sin is in the world, and it's in the world because it's in you and it's in me. But there's one thing about this matter of sin that I want just to bring out before we move on. We need to be clear what we mean when we talk about sin. When you hear that word, sin, what immediately springs to mind? Breaches of the Ten Commandments. But which ones? Is it the second six or is it the first four? You see, the seriousness of sin we see in acts that people do that we can visibly see are contrary to what God wants. But the seriousness of sin really is this, is that man is trying to live his life and shape his future without reference to God. And he could be doing this in a very upright, honest, and moral way. He can be seeking the good of his neighbour and the good of mankind. He can be striving for peace and striving for justice. And if he can be doing that in a world without reference to God, and the more he emphasises the depth, more that he emphasises his desire to live that good life without reference to God, the more he emphasises the depth to which sin has brought him. In other words, the good man, let's call him the good pagan, is saying, I do not need God to help me make a better world. I do not need God to help me make a better life. And what the preacher is doing in Ecclesiastes, to a large extent, is presenting the best of men's efforts to understand and order and shape the world he lives in. And then he shows him how it fails. Living the good life as an end in itself without reference to God is doomed to failure. He has dethroned God and put himself in God's place. There's a long poem by William Cowper, or Cooper, depending on which way you want to pronounce it, who was in the 19th century, I believe, or the 18th century. He was a great poet, and he wrote a long poem called The Garden. And one of the verses in it is this: I see that all are wanderers, gone astray, each in his own delusions. They are lost in chase of fancied happiness, still wooed and never won. Dream after dream ensues, and still they dream that they shall still succeed, and still are disappointed. That captures the essence, really, of what the man is talking about, the preacher is talking about, in these opening chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes. I've got two main headings. The first one is this. I'm just going to cover a few things that demonstrate the truth that everything turns to vapour in the end, it disappears. Man's quest to give significance to his life is a sad one, and indeed that's what the preacher found out. He deals with, in chapter 1, from verse 15 to the end, to verse 18, he deals with striving for wisdom, the sorry task of striving for wisdom. And we can see here, in verse 16, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over me in Jerusalem before me. And we can see here why some people associate this with Solomon. But still, the main thing here is striving for wisdom and knowledge surely is a good thing. Why is he saying this striving for wisdom and knowledge is vanity? Why is it vapor-like? Well, later we'll see that he says that it is a good thing, but in a different context. Here, remember, his viewpoint is under the sun. Here is man striving for wisdom and knowledge without reference to God. What does man do as he strives for wisdom and knowledge without reference to God? He identifies problems that he cannot solve. Look at verse 15. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Wisdom, no matter how deep, and knowledge, no matter how extensive, cannot solve the fundamental problems of humanity. It cannot solve the fundamental problem of inequality, of poverty, of war, and injustice in this life. And it cannot solve the ultimate problem. It cannot solve death. It cannot solve the problem of why life comes to an end. Why? Because the reason it is crooked is because it's spiritual rather than physical. What is crooked cannot be made straight. We are, because of the fall, which I mentioned earlier, we are spiritually crooked. And therefore we cannot straighten out the problem. It's the same reason that great intellectual pursuits do not result in the desired objective, that is to fulfill man's desire to understand why he is here. Man is continually disappointed. If he's really a thinking man, like the preacher, he will end up disappointed. Remember, we're looking at the horizontal here, we're not referring to God yet. God hasn't been brought into the picture yet. The pride of man in denying God and looking for answers only God can give. That's the pride of man. Looking for high things that are far too high for him, he can't reach them, or trying to discover hidden things that have been denied him by God. God will not allow us to go far enough in our fallen state to understand everything. What I'm going to do in this series, not all tonight, but I want to sort of emphasize the reality of this by quoting one or two great thinkers, men who were not Christians, but men who were thinking. I'm going to quote Kenneth Clark. Some of you may be familiar with his massive work on civilization. And it really is a good read if you have time to read it. It was made into a television program some years ago. But this was his conclusion, right at the end of the book. The trouble is, he says, the trouble is with what's wrong with civilization, the trouble is there is still no center. The moral and intellectual failure of Marxism has left us with no alternative but with heroic materialism. And it isn't enough. One may be optimistic, but one can't be exactly joyful at the prospect before us. There's a man who strived to understand, and he couldn't get there. Great intellect couldn't make it. W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, in a poem called The Second Coming, similar thing, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Why? Because the centre, if man's at the centre of it all, and you're looking for man to resolve the problems, it's going to fall apart. He can't take it. Can't sort it out. Ultimately, we end up as verse 18 in chapter 1, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. You see what he's saying? He's saying he's striving to understand, and all the learning and all of the understanding and all of the knowledge, all that he's gained, has just made him more sad because it hasn't given him the answer. And then he moves on in chapter 2 to the, in the English ESV, it's the vanity of self-indulgence. We would might call it the, in our terms, let's have a good laugh. Let's strive for pleasure. So he turns his attention to pleasure. He's been looking at wisdom and knowledge, and now he turns his attention to pleasure. But notice, it's not in a blind pursuit. He did it, he says, I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. This was a definite exercise he was on about. He hadn't abandoned what he was doing. He hadn't given it up as a bad job. He was just trying to shift. Was there some other way that we sort out life? Is it that we've got to just enjoy it? And here is a man, if you read all of that first 11, we're not going to do that, but the 11 verses of chapter 2, you'll find here a man we might envy. He had everything. He had everything he needed to pursue this self-indulgent lifestyle. He had wealth and freedom to engage in a wide range of pursuits. He had vineyards and parks, animals, wine, music, silver and gold in abundance. He is the modern equivalent of a multi-millionaire. If you read those verses, nothing could be withheld from what he wanted to pursue. But look at verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. How could he fail to be happy? Well, here is the complete contrast, if you like, with the Christian. Here is a man who has all things, yet possesses nothing. Compared to the Christian described by Paul in 2 Corinthians 6, who has nothing, yet possesses all things. That's the contrast. The trouble is, for us who are Christians, we do not act as if that were the case. It's something we need to address. Everything that matters is ours if we are Christ's. Paul said earlier in 1 Corinthians, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise that they are futile, but for you, all things are yours, the world or life or death or the present or the future, all are yours, and you are Christ's and Christ is God's. But when he said, I considered these things and it was all vanity, was he saying therefore enjoyment wasn't the right thing either? That we really should be miserable people? No, he's not saying that. What he's saying is you can't find the answers to things in self-indulgence and pleasure in having vast wealth that doesn't give you the answer you're looking for. There's nothing wrong with enjoyment. And indeed, I would say that Christians above all people should be the happiest people on earth. Because we can see the connection between what we enjoy in this world and the God who gave it. Something the preacher refers to later in verses 24. Look what he says. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? So he pursues this self-indulgence, and then he goes on to another aspect of life. He says he considered folly and madness and wisdom and came to a harsh reality that the same end befalls everybody. Paul Simon, who some of you might know as part of the group Simon and Garfunkel, wrote a song called Patterns. And one of the verses in this song, Patterns, is this. Impaled on my wall, my eyes can dimly see the pattern of my life and the puzzle that is me. From the moment of my birth till the instant of my death, there are patterns I must follow just as I must breathe each breath. Like a rat in a maze, the path before me lies, and the pattern never alters until the rat dies. There's a lad who's thought about life. Paul Simon, you see, like the preacher, thought about life in a way that few do. and discovery that at the end, it doesn't matter how much you have set yourself on a search for ultimate wisdom and understanding, you will still end up in the same way as the fool does, who's given no attention to trying to understand what life is all about. A person who's never thought about the patterns of life at all, have just lived through it. I said I was going to show one or two earthly examples. I mean, some of you may be fairly familiar with a series called The Simpsons. Full of profound thoughts in The Simpsons. And there's one episode that was even more profound, because the little daughter, Lisa, there'd been a chaotic period in their lives. And the little girl at the end is talking to her father, and she says, "Do you think, Father, that there are lessons we could have learned from all of these events, things that we were meant to learn about what went wrong?" And Homer turns to her and says, "Nah, it's just a lot of stuff that happened. Let's watch the television." And it's this contrast, you see, of people who try to work out what's going on in life, and people like Homer who just, "So what? It's just stuff that happens." And what's causing the man grief? Why is he saying this is all vanity? Is this that everything comes to the great leveler? Death. Verse 16. "For of the wise as for the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten." How the wise dies, just like the fool. So I hated life. I hated life. No remembrance. If you read Psalm 49 tonight, you'd see that it speaks of men raising monuments to themselves. But what good is a posthumous reputation to anybody? What a delusion the devil places in the hearts of men, that they should be remembered for themselves. Death is the great leveler. Doesn't matter how much power you have, it fails at the point of death. Doesn't matter how much wealth you have, it fails at the point of death. It doesn't matter how much wisdom you have, it fails at the point of death. Doesn't matter how strong you are, it everything fails at death's door. It just ends. "I hate life," wrote Voltaire, "and yet I'm afraid to die." And then the next section, chapter 2, verses 18 to 23, "What am I working for? What am I working for?" But I want to move on to the second main heading in conclusion. Because the second heading is this: the reason. What is the reason why these things have to be the way they are? Surely that must be something that we need to know. What is the reason? And the reason is that man has God out of the picture. Do you want real enjoyment? Well, we come back to chapter 2, verses 24 to 26. I said earlier that a Christian is not meant to be miserable. He's not meant to be a mournful figure. We're in a fallen world, yes. We have many difficulties, yes, just like all people. But we have something that lifts the heart. We have something that helps us not to draw the conclusion that the world draws. Here the preacher is not promoting an eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow we die philosophy. He is stating that if you recognize that what you have is from God, that he is the giver, then you are meant to find enjoyment in your labor, whatever it is. You're meant to find enjoyment in your toil. You're meant to find something satisfactory in whatever it is you do. It sort of relates to what Dan was preaching this morning from Ephesians. That great general principle in 1 Corinthians 10, whatever you do, eat, drink, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Bring all the menial tasks, bring all the mundane tasks into the light of that exhortation. Whatever I do, I'll do it for him. And suddenly, enjoyment takes on a totally new meaning. Look carefully at verse 26 of chapter 2. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. Basically, what it's saying there, those who do not know God are striving for the best they can, but they are doomed to suffer the loss of what they've worked for. Is that you? It's a question you need to ask. You're not striving to lose what you're working for, but you will if God is out of your picture. But the Christian, however, responds to the wondrous mercy and grace of God in Christ Jesus, presents him or herself as a living sacrifice, as Paul said in Romans 12. And then from that, the ideas and the values that flow from that consistent, that understanding that we are caught up in the center of God's will for us, we see them ourselves in the world in a way that it ought to be. The Christian has been given a cultural mandate. We're in the world, but not of the world. Redemptive agents in a fallen culture is what we are called to be. And the result is godliness with contentment. What is that? That's just real joy. No God in the picture, no satisfaction in life. Sadness at the end. Judgment, and we'll come to that later in the series. So you see, there is an opportunity for real enjoyment, but it can only come in one way. It can only come through God himself. And then through chapter 3, we've got that very, very well-known passage, haven't we? For everything, there is a season and a time to be born and a time to die. It's just presenting the order of the events of life. Everything fits into the first line, a time to be born and a time to die. In fact, if you take a time to be born and then just take and a time to die and put a time to die at the end of verse 8, you get the picture. There's a time to be born and then all the events of life and at the end, a time to die. But the main point of this is that it's all part of a great scheme. For everything there is a season and a time. How can that be? Well, somebody's done it. Somebody's put it into an order. The scheme's been set. And the person who's given that scheme, who's made that scheme, is God himself. It sort of has echoes of Psalm 139, verse 16. All the days ordained for me have been written in his book before one of them came to be. All the days ordained for me. Here we have a foundation of that great general biblical principle that all things work together for good for those who are called according to God's purpose. No doubt that everything in this range of events speaks of perpetual change. It does. It's utter folly to seek lasting happiness in such a volatile environment. But when we know the author of such an environment, when we know that author is in control and is ordering it to his end, and that my times are in his hands, all is well. All is well with me, and all is well with the world in which I live. Like David, we serve God in our generation. And when God determines that that work is done, we will, like David, fall asleep. That's what it's recorded like in Acts. But until then, until that point, I'm immortal. I am invincible. Even in my frail and decaying body, God's work must be done, and man is immortal until it be done. So said Charles Bridges. Thomas Goodwin, who was a great Puritan theologian and preacher, coming to his dying day, used these words on his deathbed, is this dying? How have I dreaded as an enemy this smiling friend? In this final section for this evening, we see something wonderfully profound. The reason that there can be no such thing as an atheist. It is also something that if we really grasp it, really understand it, it's beautiful. How is this? Everything is in its right place. Everything is fitting God's plan and purpose. Look at verses 10 and 11. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. As man, as you and I look out on the scene called life and see it in motion, this constant change and yet constant sameness, and we ask the question why, it's because God has put the question in our hearts. He has put eternity in our hearts. The very question God has set in your heart is to ask why. And that is why there is no atheist. There are people who are subduing the truth that's been revealed to them, as Paul does it so eloquently in Romans chapter 1. And why is this question coming from us? Because far from being a physical entity, we are primarily spiritual entities. And that is why we ask ultimate questions. We have got a memory of our eternalness within us, which we lost at the fall. It was ruined at the fall, sorry. I should say that. The fall was a ruin. It wasn't an annihilation. There's something still there in every man. What the preacher is leaving us with is the solution to a very difficult conundrum. What is the purpose of life? Notice it's not the answer to every difficulty. The purpose to which you and I fit in as we live under heaven is this. Everything serves God's purpose. Even you serve God's purpose. The question before you is this. Do you know that you are serving God's purpose? Do you know that you're serving God's will? Only through faith in Jesus Christ, in the forgiveness of your sins, can you know, really know, that life is worth living and that you have a Lord that's worth loving. Amen. We're going to close by singing 314, 314.